We're talking with Hugo Van Worden on 29th November 1973. And now you were a contemporary with Van der Holst, more or less, right?
To some extent. Yeah. He's 8 years older, but we were good friends in 1944 when he was studying at Leiden for 3 months as an assistant, working with Oort and working in particular on the prediction of the 21 centimeter line, which has made him famous. The colloquium of the Nederlands Astronomen Club, where he gave this prediction,
right,
was in Leiden in April 1944.
In April?
In April 1944. I can't give the exact date, but I would have to calculate
it. The paper is dated June, so that must be when he wrote up the paper.
That's possible, sure. It was a Saturday in the middle of April, so it's very easy to locate the exact... Almost
okay.
About the 15th of April, I know. And he'd been working on this prediction in a room which he shared with me.
I see.
And so we had been talking quite a bit of problems of interstellar matter. Although I must confess that when he gave this paper... including this prediction, that I have not fully realized the importance of this prediction. I was only a boy of 17 years old. I just passed my final school exam the summer before. Universities were closed, but Oort had invited me as a volunteer in Leiden Observatory to get acquainted with astronomy.
So you were really just a freshman there, unofficially?
I was an unofficial freshman, yeah. And got to know Van der Holst at that time. That's the only thing I really recall about that particular
right.
occasion in 1944. And we later reconstructed the event in the course of a movie which was made in 1957 about...
You told me about that.
...about the construction of the Dwingeloo telescope. And so essentially all the people who had been in at the 44 colloquium were then reconvened, and some small parts of the colloquium were given again, and I was in on that too. But at that time, of course, I knew perfectly well what was going on.
Yeah, right. Yeah, he told me about that, and there's a picture in Hay's book also, taken from that movie.
Taken from that movie, that's fine, indeed.
So you studied astronomy then at Leiden, I guess, after the war in earnest?
After the war in 45, I started normal undergraduate studies, and I'll go ahead.
Yeah, thank you.
I must confess that in those three undergraduate years in which I did regular astronomical studies, that there was little mention of the importance of radio astronomy. I took the normal undergraduate courses in general astronomy and statistical astronomy, the first one given by Osterhoff, first by Walter, Low Walter's father, who died halfway the course, and then Osterhoff took it over. The statistical astronomy was given by Oort, and that was for undergraduates and graduates at the same time, so it was extremely difficult, and even the graduate students had great trouble in following it, and usually took it 2 years so as to understand it, which is the same thing that I did. But in that course, about as much of the structure of the galaxy as was known at that time, I have not picked up anything about the importance that radio astronomy could have. And I suppose Oort shied away from the subject because it was not developed at all.
Mm. And he was certainly the only one there, besides maybe Van der Holst, who appreciated radio astronomy.
Yes, but Van der Holst wasn't there during my undergraduate years.
He went to Yerkes. Yeah.
Yes, Van der Holst, in 44 he was still studying, although in fact he was writing his thesis at that time. In 46 he got his doctor's degree, went to Yerkes, came back in 48.
Well, he's told me all about him.
Sure.
Tell me about him.
Yeah. And in 50, when I had started graduate studies after being in the army, Van der Holst gave the course in radio astronomy.
Oh yes, the very first, probably the first one ever.
The first course in radio astronomy, probably, about antennae, about receivers, receiver noise,
right,
about the sun, and cosmic sources about which very little was understood at that time yet. And Oort attended that course regularly because he wanted to know thoroughly and to learn about radio astronomy. The course was given in extended form in Harvard in early 51 and, mm-hmm. and then published in mimeograph form,
right.
which I think also was the first sort of book about radio astronomy.
Yeah, that's right.
And it came out then in 51, I suppose, after Westerhout and I had done a lot of work on the stencils on which it had been made. At the same time, in late 1950, I think, Müller and Hochhaus started working for the Foundation for Radio Astronomy, which had been founded in 1949.
Right.
And they started building the first receiver and designing the big 25-meter dish, which would be coming into operation only several years later.
But you weren't thinking of yourself at this time as being a radio astronomer?
No, not at all.
Or going into that?
Yeah. I think at that time it was not fully realized by students how important this was going to be. And the only student at Leiden in 1950 who was really strongly interested in radio astronomy was Gert Westerhout. He started working in that from his very first days as a graduate student.
Right.
He and I were starting together as graduate students in 1950.
Right, and he co-authored that paper with Oort on the structure and all. Well, not the structure, but from the continuum measurements. So when did you first really get interested in radio astronomy? What was it that struck you about this field, or how did that happen?
I think it was in 51. In the spring of 51, the first observations of the 21-centimeter line were done. And of course, these were announced at the observatory, and there was quite a bit of excitement about it. And that did not pass unnoticed. Although at that time I had not taken part in the observations. The observations were done by Müller and Oort, I think together with Gert Westerhout. He must have been at Kootwijk.
You never observed at Kootwijk yourself?
To some extent, but not not really in radio astronomy. Maybe I could explain as follows. These first measurements in Kootwijk, they took only a couple of weeks. Müller and Oort made a series, published it in Nature. Then the receiver was taken apart and
right.
very strongly improved. In 52, new observations, the first real survey of the galactic belt was started.
Mm-hmm.
But before that was done, at a staff meeting of the observatory, Oort asked for some volunteer to go to Kootwijk to do optical calibrations of the telescope.
I see.
To calibrate
the
scales and really do pointing corrections, you could say. And I volunteered for that and spent 6 weeks at Kootwijk getting this thing into order. It was, of course, a radar dish. It had very sloppy scales, very inaccurate. The zero of azimuth was about a degree off.
Hmm.
And the markings were at irregular intervals.
How repeatable was it?
I think the final accuracy of results in the pointing was of the order of a tenth of a degree or somewhat better. But I cannot remember very well because it's now 21 years ago.
But that was pretty good. I mean, it was certainly sufficient with your, what was it, 2-degree beam?
2-degree beam, indeed, yeah. Well, certainly that went well. And I did it really from the optical side. There was a lot of observing of stars to get pointing data,
mm-hmm.
Various directions in the sky, and we made the link between optical and radio by observing the sun. We had a small telescope which was used for the stars. That was also used then to look at the sun. The same time the mast was pointed at the sun,
mm-hmm.
and so we found the relationship between the radio axis and the optical
right.
axis,
hmm.
and so on, of course. A description of that work is one of the sections of BAN 452, which is the major von der Hülst-Müller-Oort paper that contains the first spiral map of the galaxy.
It is buried in there somewhere.
I think section 2 there.
I haven't gone through that paper in detail.
From my report. And in fact, after that first survey, which was published in 54, was completed observationally, Muller rebuilt his receiver, and a second survey was started in November 53. And before we started that one, I also recalibrated the whole positioning system briefly, because we had experience. It could be done in a couple of days.
Polish it up more or less.
Yes. Observations at Kootwijk were done at that time by a whole flock of students. A few dozen have been involved. Some astronomical students, but mostly hired students from all sorts of other subjects. I've never been there myself. I was heavily occupied in photometric work at the observatory. I was really an optical astronomer at that time, not a radio astronomer at all. I've been involved with that particular work once in, I think, April 53, for the reduction of the first survey, which I just mentioned. Van der Hulst was going to give the Halley lecture, which I think was in May 53, and of course it's published in Observatory.
Well, he's told me this story.
Sure. About how he hired all the...
Everyone into the room.
And you were
one of the ones.
I was one of those about 15 people who were working in the Collège Saal, reading graphs and applying all sorts of corrections.
This was a couple of weeks solid of this sort of thing?
I suppose. I'm not quite sure how long it took, but it must have been some considerable time of that sort. Okay. And the result of that then was... do you want some more of this?
Yes, please.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
And the result of this was published in BAM 452 in May 54. A few months earlier, I guess, a major colloquium had been given at Leiden about this work, which I followed very closely. And I went to South Africa in...
By whom?
By the whole crowd. By Van der Hulst and Oort and possibly other people who had been working with him. It must have been a two-hour affair at least. I had many pages of notes. And when, in March 54, I went to South Africa to be an assistant in the Leiden Observatory Southern Station for half a year, I took these notes with me and gave a colloquium at Cape Town, and also at Bloemfontein Boyden Station, and later at Johannesburg and at Radcliffe about these results. And people were very excited about them, because this was the first time, really, that the structure of the galaxy was becoming clear.
But the optical astronomers were willing to take this at face value, then?
Yes, they certainly trusted these results. There was no doubt about that.
So they didn't consider this as some weird fringe of astronomy?
Oh, no. No, it was clear that... this work on the distribution of neutral hydrogen in the galaxy was considered by all the astronomers to be one of the major advances and of great importance to understanding our galaxy. Of course, the first announcement of these results had been given already in the summer of 1952. The first survey started in May 52, probably, after my calibrations were ready. And then in September 52, the IAU had its assembly in Rome. And in Rome, the first sketches of spiral arms, a very incomplete map, but some sketches, were shown by Oort, and were there one of the highlights, together with Bahr's announcement about the distance scale of the universe, which had to be blown up because of the new Cepheid calibration. Also, at the same time, around the same time, Oort had been to South Africa in 52 and had given there some lectures about this. So, the South African astronomers, when I was there in 54, they were very happy with this colloquium. Although the attendance was small in these observatories, there were only between 5 and 15 people at the various places. So in 54 I was in South Africa, and after coming back, and even before I went, my colleagues as graduate students were working hard on these things. Kray and Westerhout were doing the rotation curve, which was published in BAM 458 at the end of 1954, based on the second survey. And then Westerhout started working on the outer parts of the system,
right.
Schmidt on the inner parts. Raymond, Ollengren, and Walcher did some smaller jobs. And I still was a bystander until the second survey was published in BAM 475. And I've been doing optical astronomy till I got my doctorandus degree in the summer of 55. And only after that, when thinking about my thesis subject, I decided to become a radio astronomer, or at least to work in radio astronomy.
Was this influenced by the fact that the Big Dish would be coming right along?
Yes, very very much so. In the fall of 55, I was making these plans for my thesis, and first choice was a subject in the relationships between meteors and comets. But Oort didn't like that. He thought that I would have to go abroad to do that sort of work, and so he could not have influence on the subject. And he was much more happy about the second subject that I had on my list, which would be a detailed study of the properties of interstellar clouds with the Dwinglo dish, which was then imminent. It was going to be operational in early 56, so I knew that I could essentially start my thesis work right there. So after some discussion, we decided that I would work on that particular subject, the properties of interstellar clouds. And I should say that the choice of that subject had indeed been, if this is within the boundaries of what you would like to have on the tape, had been influenced very strongly by several people. I've always been interested in interstellar matter back from 1942, when I first met Oort, and he gave a colloquium about, or a popular talk about nova shells in Arnhem, where I lived. And then later in 44, when I met Van der Hulst, as mentioned previously. Mm-hmm. And in 51, Blau gave a colloquium, a splendid colloquium at Leiden, about expanding associations and their role in star formation. And Van der Hulst gave a beautiful course on interstellar matter and problems of bright rims and their possible importance for star formation. And Oort was working with Spitzer on the relationships of all stars and interstellar matter, cloud motions. So that really turned me on.
Of course, there was all the dust work also,
and
Van der Hulst.
That was somewhat older. That was in 46.
That's true. That was, yeah.
That was really in the war years. But it's those three events in 1951 which really struck me,
mm-hmm.
and which sort of dictated my choice for later. And then around 55, I think also there was some influence by Bock, because at Leiden, the work in radio astronomy in the 21 centimeter line was very strongly concentrated on the structure of the galaxy.
Right.
And Bock was looking at some of the problems of the details of the interstellar medium. And I found that very, very fascinating because of its possible relationship with star formation.
Mm-hmm.
So the details of my plan had been quite a bit influenced too.
So it was really star formation that was interesting you
yes.
ultimately.
Mm-hmm. Which may again be an indication of my optical interest. Okay, so in early 56, I did the detailed preparations for my observing program at Dwinglo. In April 56, the telescope was inaugurated by our Queen. A few months later, the calibration work was started by Westerhout, and together with Raymond and Ponson and other students. Then they did the continuum survey around the galactic belt, including the region of the galactic center. And I suppose he must have told you many things about
that.
Yeah,
he's told me a number of stories about those days.
I don't think I'll speak about details of the inauguration, but on the 10th of October then, till the 5th of November, we had the first 21 centimeter line period at Dwingeloo, which to me was the first real experience in radio astronomy as an observer.
Mm-hmm.
I had optical observing experience, but nothing in radio so far. So Gert Westerhout, who of course was already, let us say, not a big man, but a man with a lot of experience in radio astronomy, came to Dwingeloo with us and instructed us for the first 2 days. Ernst Raymond was with me during those 4 weeks at Dwingeloo. Ernst had been working at Kootwijk, I had not. So, well, we got instructed in the use of the telescope and the receiver. And then Ernst and I filled 24 hours of observing for 24 days at a stretch. And that was the first period of line work in Dwingeloo, which furnished some outstanding successes, I think I could say.
So the procedure was to observe yourself.
Mm-hmm.
When did the Waarnemer system start? This was a matter of interest.
The Waarnemer system with hired students already had started at Kootwijk.
That's true, that's right.
In
you mentioned that, yeah.
52 or 53, at least in 53.
Then why didn't you hire students?
Well, in Dwingeloo, when we started that line work, as earlier in Kootwijk, and later sometimes too, we found that with a new system it is much better to have astronomers doing it first, breaking the instrument in, developing procedures,
and so
finding out
about
the properties of the instrument, etc., etc. And it was only after almost a year that we started hiring people to do the actual observing.
That might have been a good idea at Western York.
Maybe. Of course, there the thing was
so
was
to
developed to a much higher degree and more automated and on a larger time scale than at Dwingeloo.
That's an aside.
At Dwingeloo was at that time it was very hard work. We had to do essentially everything by hand. Of course, in those days, 56, the setting of the telescope via a pilot, which could be set in right ascension and declination, and then the pilot, as we call it, did the transformations to azimuth and elevation, and then steered the radio telescope.
It did track.
It did track, sure.
Yeah.
At Kootwijk, not.
Right,
there,
yeah.
One had to make hand corrections to the setting all the time. Now, at Dwingeloo was tracking, but you had to make the initial settings to watch for errors all the time, although these normally were not very large. Had to set bandwidth and starting frequency for tuning in the line, set the tuning rate and all those things, and all that was very primitive. For instance, if you changed bandwidth, say from 140 kHz, which we used mostly in the first period, to 10 kHz, which we used for some programs.
Are you referring to the filter?
Yes.
Widths, and you had a bank of, or was
it
only
one? No, it was just one channel.
Just one, and you scanned through.
There was one channel, and if one wanted to use a different bandwidth, then a lot of cables had to be changed. And if one wanted a different tuning rate, then a gearbox had to be taken out, and another gearbox to be put in with all sorts of screws and etc.
This essentially gave you a different integration time if you had a different tuning rate.
Yes, well, the standard was that there was only one time constant available, which I think was 48 seconds. No, 64 seconds. And the standard procedure was to scan through one bandwidth in four or five time constants.
Oh, that would be the point, right. So when you changed the bandwidth, you also had to change the tuning rate.
Had to change the tuning rate, sure.
What was mechanically being adjusted now? You say there were all sorts of gears?
The tuning was done via a gearbox, there was a wheel that you could turn, and which changed, of course, the setting of the condenser.
I see. Okay.
And that was driven by some motor, and that motor went then via a gearbox, which was different for the various tuning rates. Also, the Brown recorder, the strip chart, had to be operated at different speeds for different programs. So that was also a change of gearbox. And it was automatic volume control with various checks and settings to be made and shifts of the DC level, etc.
Yeah.
These are minor things, but the major worries, for instance, were the clocks. As I remember, during... Hello.
Okay, well, the important things about...
I was talking about the clocks. These were not at all reliable at that time. We had some electronic system with multipliers or the divisors or something. And in principle, it worked to an accuracy of a number of seconds a day, I guess. So between 10 minus 4 and 10 minus 5, something. But at every odd moment, one of these multipliers would step out of function and would divide by 11 or divide by 9 instead of by 10. So that...
Was there any signal for this, or you just had to...
No, you had to just watch out for it. And then if this happened, of course, then the sidereal time was suddenly off. And that also meant that the telescope was pointing the wrong direction.
Right.
The hour angle was off. So we had to watch for this and then redo observations immediately when this was found. And always ask Müller, call him at night or so, to reset things, because we didn't know the details of the electronics. And in order to be sure of the correct time, we had a rather intricate system. We could get time signals a couple of times per day via the radio, partly from rugby and partly via an amateur set, which we had to listen to at 12 o'clock in the daytime or say 6 o'clock in the evening for the famous six pips, which the BBC transmits then.
Well, what do you mean by an amateur set? You mean you had a separate little...
Just an amateur-built radio set,
which
would pick up these signals. And so we had to be there at that specific time to take these signals and then use these as a calibrator for the Leiden Observatory chronometer, which we had there, and which had corrections of many seconds per day.
And it's not much of a chronometer.
It was not a very good chronometer. Of course, the best one was at the Optical Observatory. We had a rather poorer one. And so we had to keep track of its corrections, and then the chronometer at every odd time served as a check on the sidereal clock that was in the receiver.
But weren't there at this time electric clocks that were tied into the power system?
No. In fact, one of the other problems was that the mains power was not reliable. I remember that electric clocks that you have in the streets at that time were not running reliably as they do now. They could be off by several minutes.
Yeah.
So there was no way of doing it that way.
Well, what came out of these 3 weeks of observations?
That, of course, was the most important thing. But I should add, indeed, one other trouble that we had, because there was really more. I was saying that we had to handset positions, but before having those, we had to calculate right ascension and declination from longitude and latitude by spherical trigonometry, because there were no Lund observatory tables convert from alpha delta to LB. They appeared about a month later.
So you had to do this with...
We had to do that just with a logarithm table for every individual observation, every hour, essentially. And in addition to that, apply refraction corrections, which close to the horizon were quite important, say a tenth of a degree at... I can't remember exactly. A tenth of a degree at about 10 degrees altitude.
10 degrees,
And a lot of the observing was below that altitude, in particular in the region of the galactic center.
Yeah.
And in addition, we had to calculate all the frequency corrections because of the Earth and Sun's motion with respect to the local standard of rest. So for every individual profile, at least in galactic work, we had to make those calculations. And so while an observation was running, I was always making all these calculations for the next one.
No one ever thought of having a second pilot for LB to Alpha Delta?
We talked about it, of course, but such a thing costed an enormous amount of money. That was not available. So all this was done while observing, and then we had shifts where one person was working in the evening up to 6 o'clock in the morning, and the other took from 8 in the morning to, say, 8 in the evening or 10 in the evening or something like that. Our program consisted of various subjects. The Andromeda Nebula, the galactic center region, absorption spectra of point sources, the Orion Association, and various small things on which we spend very little time, of course, such as possible gas in the halo, gas in direction of stars with interstellar absorption lines, a few other associations, and probably several small subjects which I can't remember now.
But hold it now, where does your thesis topic fit into this?
My thesis topic was the Orion Association.
But you said that it was going to be properties of clouds.
Now, yeah.
You narrowed it down to studying a specific...
Right, properties of region. Clouds. I think you tracing back from what I said about the influence of Blau and so on, and my interest in star formation, I had decided that I wanted to study the properties of interstellar clouds in a few of the major associations. First choice, Orion. Second choice, Scorpius.
Okay.
So that is why these two things were on the program. But they were not a top priority on the program. The program had been laid down really by Professor Oort and van der Hulst. And the top priority subjects were the Andromeda Nebula and the galactic central region. And 3 and 4 were the absorption spectra of point sources and the Orion Association. And as I remember, we made, during those 4 weeks, something like 493 measurements, which then on average must have taken about an hour. And of those, about 25 were spent on the Orion Association, so only 5%. Yeah. Although maybe they averaged something like 2 hours each, because they were narrow band and therefore slow.
Now the rationale for the programs, the M31, I guess, was a natural extension of the galactic structure, where you could start.
Not really. Well, you could say so, but M31 it was the first extragalactic work in the hydrogen line.
Well, this is not the Magellanic Clouds.
Quite. The Magellanic Clouds had been done by Kerr and Company, and Hessian had announced neutral hydrogen in the Coma cluster,
right,
which was later refuted. But M31, indeed, was going to be the first study of an external galaxy for, indeed, a rotation curve, the general distribution of neutral hydrogen in the system. And it is true that the planning of these observations had been done on the basis of a prognosis which had been written by van der Hulst, and which was based on the data from our own galaxy. So you could say that was an extension of the Kotwek work on galactic structure, and that would be reasonable. I think that's enough of a rationale,
yeah,
for that program. It,
yeah,
was not my personal program.
No, I was just trying to get some idea of why it was given such high priority.
Well, the high priority was in the fact that with this so much narrower beam of 0.6 degrees instead of 2.3, it was for the first time possible to study such an external galaxy,
right,
in any detail. And let me continue about this particular thing, if I may. We knew what sort of signals to expect in the Andromeda Nebula. We knew that they would be several degrees strong, and that they would be quite wide in velocity, at various positions, rather different, but often of the order of 100 kilometers a second.
Yeah.
But Westerhout and I did not realize immediately how this was going to affect our observations. The first attempts that we made to work on this were by using the old-fashioned Kotwek technique of scanning profiles. So set the frequency at one end of where you think that you get your radiation, and then start the tuning motor and scan through the line profiles in possibly half an hour or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get the profile displayed for you. But the trouble with this was that the velocity range was quite wide, and more than 1 megahertz, and the baseline of the receiver had a very considerable amplitude, I think of the order of 20 Kelvin or so, maybe even more, which meant then that from the one end of the profile to the other, there was a very strong change in zero level, and therefore it was essentially impossible to see what the profile looked like. And so after a few attempts, we decided that this didn't work. We couldn't see anything.
Well, it was not only a bit wider than the galaxy, but it was so much weaker than the galaxy.
Yes, that too. So there were two reasons why it didn't work. And then we tried a different method, which also had been used at Kotlek, the so-called B measurements, which is drift scans, constant declination, scan in Reiter's engine, and at a constant frequency.
Right.
And with that, we could see some signals, although not very strong, because the receiver was rather noisy. It was a 2000 Kelvin system. So for a time constant of 1 minute and a bandwidth of 140 kilohertz, it was easy to calculate. It would be a root mean square noise of about 1 Kelvin. And therefore a signal of maybe 5 Kelvin would not be very easy to see. Also, one didn't know really where the radiation would start and where it would end on such a drift scan.
Right.
So these results remained uncertain and difficult to use, and they were very time-consuming. And then von der Hulst came after a few days to see what sort of results we had, and we had nothing satisfactory. And he talked about it with us, and we came to the conclusion, I think he proposed it really, that we should start a different sort of measurement, namely set on a particular position in the Andromeda Nebula, and then for comparison set somewhere else at a place which was obviously outside of the system.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, I suppose, the first time that the on-off measurements were started.
Yeah, he told me that, and he thought that was true also. Right.
Mm-hmm. This was a new method then. Well, details about that work, of course, are in the literature, in BAN 480. The profiles that we finally made then were put together by 6, 10, 15 measurements at various frequencies, each an hour or 2 hours long. Each setting on and setting off were 15 minutes. So the total time spent on the Andromeda Nebula must have been of the order of 200 hours or so.
Mm.
In that particular period. The results were in rather good agreement with the theory. I think they were about a factor two lower. The Andromeda Nebula has less gas than we thought.
It's you mean the percentage of gas to total mass?
Yes, I think you could put it that way. Or the surface density of gas in that system is somewhat lower than our galaxy. But it was close enough that we could do the observations according to a reasonable schedule that one could lay down. Although how far we should go out from the center was found by trial and error. And the last observations we did were 2 3/4 degrees on the major axis.
Had you run out of signal by that time? Or?
Yeah. They were essentially zero. Ernst Raymond did most of that observing. And also started the reductions. Later, when he was enlisted in the army in December 56, von der Hulst, who had given him an outline of how to do it, and I took it over, and so we brought the work to completion and submitted it to BAN in the spring of 57.
So that's your first paper in radio astronomy?
Yes, in which I was author number 3 then, von der Hulst, Raymond and van Woerden. In fact, that was not the first paper in radio astronomy. The second subject on which we were working during that period furnished the paper quite a lot faster. And that was the work on the galactic central region, and for which the results were more unexpected and therefore deserved indeed a quicker announcement. It was my particular duty at that time, which had had been given to me by Oort to study the properties of the neutral hydrogen in the region of the galactic center, because the Kolchak surveys had shown quite a lot of incomprehensible results, so to say. In the inner parts of the galaxy, the line profiles were known to be very wide and very weak, with long tails, which we called long toes at that time. And this was interpreted in the paper about the rotation curve as strong turbulence in the inner parts, although it was also realized that there was a little arm quite close to the galactic center, about which nothing had been published, but which was obvious in the catalog of line profiles, which was published in BAM 475.
It's not mentioned at all.
No, there's no specific mention made of it. Oh, by the way, do you think I'm making enough noise for the recording?
Oh, certainly.
Even if I'm talking in different directions? Okay.
It's sensitive. So, this was the 3 kiloparsec arm you're referring to.
Later it got that name then. Oort asked me to look for the extent of all this diffuse hydrogen matter there, extent in velocity, in longitude and latitude of these long toes. And I did this by making drift curves at constant declination at various at various frequencies to scan brightness temperature as a function of bright ascension. And of course it was always only in one channel, but I used the wide channel of 140 kHz, so 30 mm-hmm. kilometers a second, because the radiation was weak and we did not expect much velocity structure in it. And I found hydrogen with velocities out to almost 300 kilometers a second, I think, each way, both positive and negative. And once the extent on the sky of these things was determined, I also took some profiles to get a better view of what the velocity structure was.
How far had the long attainment gone out?
In velocity, to almost 300 kilometers a second.
So this was a verification of...
The earlier observations at Kolchak, they had not shown such high velocities, I think. Although over 200 probably in places, because the Kolchak receiver was quite good. It had, it must have had a similar front end. It had a bandwidth of 40 kilohertz. It had Rubin square noise in general of 0.7 Kelvin in the profile catalog. The one at Dvingelo, I think, was basically the same receiver. It had stronger problems with baseline, with zero line, probably because the feed was different, was a new feed. So it has taken a couple of years before we really had a good zero line. But then, with my work on the Langeteinen, I was able to show weaker radiation in the galactic center region, for one thing, because I used the wider band.
Mm-hmm.
And the exciting result that came out of this was really the dips in the drift curves when crossing Sagittarius A and its surroundings, but very strongly on Sagittarius A. This was quite noticeable on the scans. And it was very important because at that time the nature of Sagittarius A as a radio source was not known.
Right, and there was a debate in the literature about whether it really was the center of the galaxy.
Sure. It was known that it was very close to the galactic center in position on the sky, but there was a debate whether it was at the center in the nucleus or possibly a more local radio source. There was a suggestion that it might be at 3 kiloparsec distance, related to an H2 region that was visible there optically. And there were various arguments for or against, which I can't remember in detail. But then this discovery of the dips on Sagittarius A in absorption at high velocities of 50 kilometers a second and up was a decisive thing, because it showed that hydrogen with velocities which were strongly forbidden in the direction of the galactic center, where all systematic velocity should be zero, was between us and the source. Now, we knew that this hydrogen with such irregular velocities was only seen in the innermost parts of the galaxy, where this turbulence or these long tows were observed. Mm-hmm. So it was obvious that this absorbing hydrogen must be in the inner parts of the system. Therefore, Sagittarius A had to be either in the inner parts or behind.
Right.
And to have it behind the center, of course, didn't make any sense. So this certainly showed that Sagittarius A was in the nucleus of the galactic system.